I just wanted to get a group of people together to talk about pseudo-spectral methods, even though the conference isn't about numerical methods, it's more about the nature of turbulence.
Aliens!
Help us understand about the nature of turbulence, we sometimes need numerical methods, there's more about tools and toolbox. And there have been some recent advances that I wanted to tell you about. So I have a few slides prepared. I don't want to be really formal session though. And then CJ Chan's going to tell about some recent work he's doing on working the sheared box. And then also Yuko Kaneda is going to talk to us about where is he? He's looking for the room.
I'll.
If you can find him, yeah.
I'll try to fish him.
I told everybody this morning.
He's probably fooling around.
You have one of those.
Yeah, there's multiple speakers, so you have to pass them on.
Yeah, sure. We will do that. Yes, we'll do that. And so the other issue, we want to talk about parallelization, which is very important. I'm not going to say much about that, but I'll be happy to contribute to the discussion.
You probably want to put that mic near your voice.
Okay. All right. How was that? Well,
it's not much difference. Us.
Yeah, not for us, no. Okay. All right. So my student, Malcolm Roberts, in the first row here, and I, a year ago, were discussing, a little over a year ago, we were discussing the methods that are used for de-aliasing pseudospectral simulations, pseudospectral convolutions. And it seems there's, I was telling him how it works in 1D and how much worse it is in 2D and 3D, at least if you do zero padding, explicit zero padding, it seems like a terrible waste. I mean, you're writing all these zeros to memory, then you're reading them back in, and then multiplying by them and computing sums of zeros. And what's the point of that? There's got to be a better way to do it. Well, just to tell you what our findings here are, I guess first what Malcolm said, yeah, there's got to be a better way to do it than that. And I said, well, I know, I've been thinking about it for years, but I've never found a better way. And it turns out in one dimension, we still have not got a better way of doing it. But in 2D and 3D, the situation is different, and that's what most people here are interested in. And so I think this work is quite relevant. We save memory, and we save computer time as well. Okay, so, all right, so I will start just to set the notation here. So here's a discrete cyclic convolution that's provided by the FFT. Of course, one of the problems that we have is that we don't want a cyclic convolution. In other words, it has aliases. We want to get rid of those aliases and compute a linear convolution. So just to set the notation, I'll find it convenient to call the roots of unity. Sometimes people call these twiddle factors. But they're just roots of unity. I'll use the notation zeta for that. And so what the fast Fourier transform method exploits is that if you take this thing and raise it to the rth power, that in the case where r divides n is equivalent to taking zeta with the a reduced denominator here, n over r. So that property there is used. So R divides N here. And this one, of course, is a trivial consequence, too. And those are the only two things that are really used in the fast Fourier transform method, which we'll use today a lot. We're going to use sort of the physics notation here, thinking of plane waves here. That's how I decide on the sign there. That's the backwards Fourier transform, getting back into X space. So J is like X space here, and K represents wave number. So that's the discrete Fourier transform. Here's the forward transform. It has the minus sign in it. Of course, different books differ on the conventions there. And I put the 1 over n out here. And of course, the important property in the convolution theorem that you exploit is the orthogonality of this pair. And the point is that when you sum up these things, you get a geometric series, which works out to 0 unless this number L, this is like the wave number here, unless it happens to be a multiple of n. And so what we're interested in physically is a case where L is 0, but there are these other multiples of n. Any multiple that you could generate is of a concern. And that corresponds to waves, of course, beating together to add up to a mode that's periodic to a negative mode in your system, perhaps, and contaminating your spectrum. Okay, so we have to get a linear convolution. And so the one way of de-aliasing is by zero padding. So this is the usual procedure that most people are using, although I understand some people in 3D are using phase shift de-aliasing. We can talk about that as well. This is the zero padding technique. You have your two vectors. You want to find the convolution. So you zero pad them, then you take the inverse Fourier transform, get back into X space, and then multiply them together. Notice you now have, instead of m data, m is the number of modes. So instead of m data values, you have 2m data values in X space in both cases. Then you multiply them there pointwise, and then you take the Fourier transform back to K space, and you throw out all this data. But so you see all those extra zeros that we don't really want to have. And we certainly don't want to use up the memory reading those things in either. We have to remember memory bandwidth to memory is much slower than CPU in modern machines. That's the von Neumann bottleneck. And so we want to come up with a, we're willing to do more work in the CPU if we have to avoid having to do that. So physically, as I said, it removes this unphysical beating of modes, m minus 1, the highest wave number in the system, from beating around to contaminate mode n, which is 0 mod n. So big N here is twice little m. And so you actually need, I've worked out here, you need big N. So m is the number of physical modes, and big N is the number of the size of your buffer here. There it is there, 2m minus. Well, actually, I've increased it one to one more. You actually, there's 2m minus 2 modes. No, I'm sorry, there's 2m modes there. You could actually get away with just 2m minus 1. But for technical reasons, people usually bump that up to 2m, just because the FFTs, which are powers of 2, tend to be more efficient. And that's the case here as well. Okay, so here's what we can say about explicit padding. It's an obvious waste of computation. However, the conventional wisdom on avoiding this waste by some kind of pruning is it's just not worth it. It's better to use an optimized, highly optimized existing general FFT than trying to do some kind of pruning. And it turns out in one dimension that Stephen Johnson is right. This is what he says. It's hardly worth thinking about, okay, what I'm about to tell you today. And in higher dimensions, it says matters change. You could do some kind of pruning because you find that some of the Fourier transform you're calculating are just rows of zeros. And you can easily detect those and avoid that. So that's one optimization you can make without any need to hear this talk. However, it turns out that isn't as good as what I'm about to tell you today, and we will show you the comparison of that. So I call that pruning, kind of just a simple-minded pruning. You prune out any transform that's zero everywhere. It's very easy to do. All right, so what's the idea behind implicit padding? And that's not a question mark. That's supposed to be a reference. Somehow it didn't get resolved. Sorry. It's just been published in SIAM. I posted that material on the wiki. So there is a reference there under reference material. So in the SIAM journal on scientific computing. So here we are. We have our 2m modes here. Well, we have m physical modes, but we've zero padded here, except we're going to do the padding implicitly. We're not actually going to do this summation like this. What we want to do is only compute if the data is zero in the upper half. By the way, I'm not talking about the Fourier transform that you people will be using for turbine simulations. This is the one that will be more used in signal processing. It's a standard Fourier transform, which we can shift and put the Fourier origin in the middle. There's lots of things you can do to this to get the one that we're interested in, which is Hermitian. It's the Fourier transform of real values. But I want to start with this simple case before we get into the Fourier transform that's of use, of interest to us. So, so let's just keep things really simple. We consider the problem of a standard Fourier transform. So in other words, I'm not using the two-thirds rule here. I'm using the what do we call it, the one-half rule. Okay, half of your data is physical. Just because it's easier to explain in this scenario. Okay, so the upper half has zeros in it. So I'm not going to sum over them. I'm only going to sum from 0 to n minus 1. The trouble is that isn't the Fourier transform, because that number then, if I only sum up to n minus 1, that's not the same as that number there. And so that's a problem. This thing here is not a Fourier transform. However, I can compute, if I compute only the even and the odd components, then I can reduce this into something that is a Fourier transform. It's a subtransform of size m rather than size n. And this is the odd one. The odd one is just it's the same thing, except you have to first, this plus 1 here means you have to first scale your input vector by a factor, a k-dependent factor, before you apply the Fourier transform. And this gives you the even and odd components in X space separately by computing two subtransforms. Okay, and so the scaling, the computational scaling, is 2m log m. And in fact, it's exactly the same as the scaling of the explicit method. And it turns out it uses just as much memory as the explicit method as well. And Stephen Johnson really is right. It really doesn't help. Okay. So as Malcolm likes to say, it uses just as much memory. It takes just as long. But it's much more complicated. And that's hardly a selling feature of any method. Okay. And I'll show you how this gets coded out. This is the Fourier transform going back. Now we've got the even terms and the odd terms in X space. We have to Fourier transform. That's just straightforward. And you then get back to what you want to compute. So that shows you both transforms that you can use to build a convolution. One of the things that's nice is there's no bit reversal is required at the highest level since we're doing a convolution. And we've implemented this in our FFTW++ library. This is available on SourceForge. I think you can just Google that. It's also, there's a link from the FFTW page under languages. We've implemented a C++ header for supporting routines for this, including this complex convolution that does exactly what these transforms here. And it requires 6 out-of-place transforms. And out-of-place is nicer. In many cases, tends to be more efficient, but it does it. The whole thing is in place. It's an in-place convolution, but the subtransforms are computed in a clever way to maximize the number of transforms that can be done out of place without using any extra memory. So here's the kind of idea how it works. We take our original vector. We compute from that in X space, we can compute the cases where the even and odd components and of the two inputs of F and G. Okay, so these are in X space. Then we multiply them together, element by element, and then Fourier transform back. So everywhere else I've used N, instead of N here I had J. So we should probably fix that. Anyway, this is the routine. Like I say, it's quite complicated. Okay. Well, if you think that's bad, you should see what the Hermitian centered 1D Fourier transform looks like. It's much worse. However, that work's all been done, and it's been highly optimized. And the computational scale you get, well, here's the, again, back to the standard transform, the computational scaling is virtually identical. This is a problem size, m here, comparing explicit to implicit. Okay. So this is time I'm showing. So low is good. And within the error bars, they're quite comparable. But there's no real advantage to doing 1D, except for one little difference. This work array that you saw back here, notice how this extra work array that's used for the odd components, that's in place of zeroing the original. Initially, we had, in the explicit scheme, we had to zero this vector here. Instead of doing that, we're just adding another work array here. So we use the same amount of memory, but it's decoupled. And the fact that this is decoupled, that you don't have to copy your data into a new buffer and add zeros, like usually your buffer isn't long enough. The fact it's decoupled is the key thing that we exploit in 2D. And that's the only thing. That's the whole point of the talk, actually. Here's how it works in 2D. Here's the explicit standard convolution that you're doing, be doing in 2D. We're doing one-half de-aliasing here, so the one-half rule. And so we, in 2D, that means that we only get to keep a quarter of our data, basically. Okay. So this is all zeros out here. We Fourier transform back to X space, compute the product, and then go back, and we've got the convolution, and throw out the rest of the data. So all that's wasted space, in a sense. But it's necessary to remove the aliases. And so there's our final answer. Okay, that's explicit padding. Here's how implicit padding works. And the key thing is that the extra work memory is this thing I've shown it here. It does not need to be, this is also work memory here we need. So we do need some work memory, but not as much as we had before. In other words, we don't have this whole block. We're saving that whole block of data up here, except for one column. So what we do, the other thing we do is to reduce a 2D convolution to a series of 1D convolutions. We work directly with convolutions. We don't really want Fourier transforms, so why are we computing them? First of all, you compute the Fourier transforms, you write them to memory, then a little while later you're reading them back in and then doing the multiply. You should try to do that all in one step if you can. It's more efficient. So here's what we do. First of all, as we did before, we compute the even X-based version, even X-based components, the odd X-based components, like this, looking at just the index nx. So we're just doing an x transform right now in the x direction. And so that doubles the size of the data right there, just as before. Okay. So we do need some memory. Okay. And then now we're going to compute convolutions. So the way we do that, we're going to do a y convolution. So we're going to Fourier transform in y, and that, again, with implicit padding, that expands us out here. We need some work memory. I'm just going to Fourier transform that first column of F and the first column of G. And then we're going to dot them together. Well, it's not really a dot product, but we're going to multiply them together, element by element. Okay. So I don't need these ones anymore. This data has been used. It's been multiplied onto here. And now we want to do the inverse Fourier transform only in Y. And that gets us to this. Okay. Now that step is actually already, we don't have to redo this, what I've just done here. This step of doing the convolution in Y, I already have a routine for that, and I can make use of it. I don't have to rewrite this in terms of elementary Fourier transform. So that saved us a lot of work. Okay, so that's just a 1D convolution there. And then, now I move this work array along, sequentially along, until, after a while, I have computed all the columns of my convolution. And then I Fourier transform back, and I'm left with just this much data. So this is far better than the memory usage with explicit transforms. And the scaling is much better. It's typically a factor of two better. Okay, this is for different problem sizes at the time. And you want to compare to the explicit one, which is the red one here. You could, in view of Stephen Johnson's remark, Stephen Johnson is the author of FFTW, which is a very highly optimized library for FFTs that's portable, and it adapts to your machine. It's architecture dependent, so it's adjusted for your cache size. It's a very nice idea. He suggested this idea, though, of pruning all the zero sub-transforms. We call that Y-pruned. And yes, sometimes it helps. In fact, here it helped even better than implicit for very small transforms. And that's really more an issue of optimization. By the way, we've vectorized, to get this comparison, we've had to vectorize our FFT just like the explicit one. It's also vectorized. And anyway, but you see it performs very well. One of the reasons it performs so well as M gets large, our implicit one, the reason it performs so well is that you, by using less memory, you tend to be able to stay inside the cache more. So that's a good thing. And that's one place where the performance increase comes from. It also comes from other things too, like not doing bit reversal and not actually computing FFTs and writing them to disk, but going directly to the turn-by-turn multiply. As soon as you compute the Fourier transform of a column, you use it right away and don't try to keep it around. So in other words, you calculate the Fourier transform in blocks. Okay, you never, in any stage of this algorithm, do you have the Fourier transform of your whole field lying around. Of course, if you want it to make a movie or something, that's a different matter, and you can do that. Okay, so here is how it works in 3D, and you see it's even better. Very small sizes, it didn't pay off, but the large sizes it does, and that's what we're interested in. And again, you see that the pruned one didn't work very well. Actually, I'm not sure if I emphasize in 2D, actually the pruning turned out to be sometimes even worse than not pruning. And that's an issue of optimization. FFTW's done an awful lot to get this red curve down to where it is. Okay, and we've done our best to do the same here. It's actually very hard to be competitive. This shows it's hard, because we're actually doing the same amount of work here as FFTW, except less. I mean, we're doing less than what FFTW is doing, and yet it's still costing us more, because we're not quite as optimized there in the way. This is, if you try to write your own, I was talking to Bob Kerr. He wrote his own 2D FFT based on the 1D FFT provided by FFTW. And there was a point in time where you could do better than FFTW, but that time has long passed. They're doing something that's much more complicated than the simple-minded XY Fourier transform decomposition that is normally done. And of course, one of the big problems I want to talk about later is when you do a 2D Fourier transform, you have to, after doing the Fourier transform in X, then you have to do a transpose and do the Fourier transform in Y. Or use striding or something equivalent, which requires accessing memory locations that aren't nearby, in fact, may even be on a different machine. And so this requires a lot of communication costs. And so we're maybe going to talk about other alternatives to computing Fourier transform. Maybe the fast Fourier transform isn't the right method for massively parallel distributed architectures. In any case, this implicit padding should help in parallels. Well, we haven't parallelized our library, but it shouldn't be hard to do. You remember there was an even part and an odd part, so that will be a natural splitting. And we still have the transpose issue to deal with, though, and that's the key thing that has to be addressed. Or you just live with those communication costs, which I guess is what people are doing right now, right? So then there's a Hermitian convolution that satisfies something like this. Here, the bar is a complex conjugate. And there's a centered one. That's another thing I'd like to discuss. Because I was talking to Mikhail, and you were telling me that you put the Fourier origin at the lower left corner of your, this is your domain, you put it right there. I tend to put mine right in here, or it would be here, except I have the Hermitian symmetry. So and the Hermitian symmetry in Y is what I use. And so my origin is actually here. And I find that more convenient. And we decided we could have done it either way, but when we wrote these routines, we thought that's what most people would want. So actually, I would like to ask Professor Kaneda, where do you put the origin? Now, where is the Fourier origin in when you, like if you want to use an off-the-shelf FFT routine, the Fourier origin is always here. So you can multiply by minus 1 to the k, minus 1 to the j, and j is the x-space index. If you multiply by minus 1 to the j in x-space, then that's equivalent to shifting your Fourier origin to here. So that's what I used to do. And some of those minus 1 factors actually cancel, because you have one for each input, and they cancel out anyway. You'll have one going backwards. So you have 5 Fourier transforms to do a convolution. That's what you need. That's in 2D. So that's another matter. I just wanted to ask though to find out what people are using. You put your origin here, Miguel, and do you know offhand where your Fourier origin is, or I designed these routines, that's why I call it centered convolution, is to put the Fourier origin in the center. Here's the 1D example, so I simply put it in the center of the array at zero, and it seemed most natural. It works with the two-thirds padding, and in fact, with implicit aliasing, it turns out to be quite advantageous to do that. And it means that you can easily convert from your index to a wave number without any branching, without any if statements, okay? Or you split your loop into two pieces, the other thing you could do, which is maybe something you could consider instead. Because Mikhail is reading his wave number vectors right from memory, and I'm suggesting it would be better to compute that. Anything compute on chip is better. And there's a simple relationship between your index and your wave number. All right, so I was just talking about the two-thirds padding rule here, and this is how it turned out. The Hermitian transform, again, was competitive with the explicit method. Again, no reason to use it in 1D, but in 2D, there's a big reason to use it for large problem sizes. It turns out to be much better. And then this is how we actually use it to compute the nonlinear term in a pseudospectral code. We want to compute this advective term right here. And so that's what we're computing in Fourier space. And that's a convolution. And we'd like to we'd like to make it very easy for people to use. And so we wrote up our convolution so it could handle do this whole thing in one function call. So the advantage of that, it saved us a Fourier transform. So here I needed to do, in 2D here, I needed 5 Fourier transforms. Because these are 5 2D Fourier transforms. I needed one for each of the inputs, but then I have a term involving a PX and a term involving PY here. And so there's actually 2 Fourier transforms that have to be done for P and 2 Fourier transforms that have to be done for Q, for omega Q. And so that's 4 Fourier transforms gets you into X space. I then do this computation there, written as using the convolution theorem as a multiply. And then there's 1 Fourier transform to come back. So that's where the 5 comes from. So 2 plus 2 and then 1 to bring us back to K space. So that was the most advantageous way to write things. So this does all the work. It's just one function call, and then you simply, so my nonlinear routine in the pseudospectral code that Malcolm and I have developed has about 20 lines, and most of those lines are just setting up these input vectors, px times omega p, etc. And so there it is there. That's that quantity there. And there should be k subscripts on these omegas here. And then you simply call that function. And it does all the padding and worries about all these things. So that's quite nice. And the memory savings is quite substantial. For a standard convolution, you use, in D dimensions, you use half to the power D minus 1. So again, when D is 1, there's no memory savings, but it gets better and better as D gets higher. And the computational savings is because of increased data locality. It's about a factor of 2. So not only, we're in the best of both worlds, not only do we save memory, we also save computation time. And it's been written as a software layer, FFTW++, on top of the FFTW. It's written in C++, that's why the plus-plus is there. And we ended our paper in SIAM with this statement, writing a high-performance DALIS pseudospectral code is now a relatively straightforward exercise. And we actually wrote that statement before we actually tried. And it turned out to be relatively straightforward, but it took us a little while to realize exactly what we needed there to make it easy. And I've told a few of you about this one since it's here. I might as well advertise this graphics program that I used. I developed with Andy Hammerlindel and Tom Prince and many other contributors, students of mine, and also contributors on the net. It's a 3D and 2D graphics program called Asymptote. It's available under the GPL license. And this talk was done with it. And it allows you to do things like using 3D. That's not a very useful figure, I suppose, but that's our logo. And we've even, one of the things we've done in the last few years with this was to put tech into 3D, so you can use now tech on your axes labels. And so I have a nice plot of the gamma function. And, you know, I want to have a gamma on the magnitude of the gamma function, the complex gamma function, as a function of real and imaginary arguments. I want to plot a graph of that, and so I needed a gamma on the axes, and I wanted to have everything to be the same fonts. This looks actually much better on my screen, but if I blow in, I guess you'll be able to see that this really is vector graphics. That's just the projector that is digitizing it. So the data is stored in vector format. And I showed this to Donald Knuth at a conference last June, and he was really amazed by that. So that was pretty neat. So, for amusement, you can go look up Donald Knuth's latest creation, eTech, and he had a talk about it in San Francisco last June. It was all a joke. He claimed that he had been working, the reason we hadn't heard from him for years is he'd been working on a successor to tech that was, it would do everything. It would solve any problem, including turbulence, and everything was in there, and it was also 3D. Decided to put that in. So this is the talk didn't appear. The reference is posted on the web page anyway for the convolution stuff. So that's all I had to say about the de-aliasing issue. Maybe somebody has questions, and you can certainly give it a try. And it'll certainly take a little work. You know, recoding things to fit where I've just decided the origin should be, but we also could make a version that puts the origin somewhere else if there's some reason for it. Yeah.
So if you were to do it with a compressor code, you have trivial modifications, then you wouldn't do it by convolution anymore.
Well, we actually, I took this out, but we actually have looked at what we call ternary convolutions, things that look by. So normally you're looking at that's a normal convolution.
Yeah.
Summing over P. And now we're going to sum over one more index. We're going to have K minus P. We're going to have omega K, omega Q, omega K minus P minus Q. So I call that a ternary convolution.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So that requires a two-fourths de-aliasing rule. It's actually part of the motivation for this work, which I will talk about next week. But I guess you won't be here next week. I haven't. Assuming I'm given a talk, assuming they let me talk again. I want to talk about which direction do the higher-order Casimirs cascade in two-dimensional turbulence. We all believe that energy cascades to small scales. But there are, that's the global integral of omega squared. What about the global integral of omega cubed? Or any other C1 function of vorticity? These are all nonlinear invariants of the nonlinear term. And which way do they cascade? I should have probably talked about this last week when Gregory Ionk is here, because he says they cascade to small scales. But Polyakov says they cascade to large scales. And so I decided, well, we should have a shootout and see who's right. And it turns out that Ionk was, in fact, a purist based on numerical evidence. Okay, it appears to be that Ionk was right, that this the fourth power of vorticity, the one I've looked at, it actually does seem to cascade to small scales. Although I haven't actually checked as a cascade, but I've seen the transfer of that invariant to small scales. To do that, I needed to use a two-fourths de-aliasing rule to get the padding right. Okay, and that's actually one of the reasons we wrote this package. So we do include because of my own interest in this, we include in the library a routine for ternary convolutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know you needed it for compressible flow. This is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. We just have this in 2D right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we could.
We haven't done it in 3D yet.
Yeah, we haven't done it in 3D.
It's very easy to do.
It's very easy to do in 3D,
yeah.
But it's, you're the first person who's asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's about maybe 100 lines of code or so. It's not that much.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 3D one is based on the 2D one. and we've seen how it's, once again on the roll, you figure out how it goes. It's actually very nice that you can decompose higher order convolution in terms of lower order ones. That was a big breakthrough when I realized that. And it's really what's responsible for the fact with the usual two-thirds rule, our convolution uses 4/9 of the memory that you would use with explicit padding. And it's about twice as fast. Now, another way of de-aliasing is with phase shift de-aliasing, and some people have been using that. You've been using phase shift de-aliasing, and Hussein and Professor Kennedy, you have as well. It depends how you do it. I mean, if you do the real phase shift de-aliasing, you need to do 8 times as much work, right? You have to do, basically, instead of doing a single Fourier transform, multi-dimensional Fourier transform in n dimensions, you do 2 to the n. Prior to Patterson 71, that was the thinking. And one of the things I didn't notice in Patterson is that paper, until very recently, is that you can reduce this number of de-aliases down, number of Fourier transforms down to just 2. But then you don't get all of it right. But you get enough of the domain right. You can get all the modes in a sphere correct, and a sphere of radius up to 94% of the radius of the box, which is pretty good, and about 84% of the volume or something like this. So there's some loss in this. You only get 84% of your available spherical room that you have, but that's not too bad. But you do pay for a factor of 2 in memory, and that's where we're quite a lot better off here. We need 3/2, that's right, as opposed to a factor of 2 in memory. So we're already saving in memory. I haven't done the test. We should probably do it. Even in 2D, it would be very easy to do it in 2D and C. Except Patterson's paper was only written for 3D, so we'd have to work out with the equivalent. But we could also do it in, it wouldn't be hard to do it in 3D as well. We could do the comparison. Probably you want to do it for emission one, in case you're interested, and actually do do 2 explicit Fourier transforms and compare that to the time it would take to do one. And there's maybe a little extra time to take the difference of the two computed values to subtract off the aliases. So basically, barring any unforeseen issue, I can't see how the phase space de-aliasing could be any faster, because we already know we're using less memory, and memory is the bottleneck here. That's where even if you're not running out of memory in your machine because you have a massively parallel machine, just reading memory in is slowing you down, and that's what we want to avoid. So like I say, the phase shift uses twice as much memory, gives you back 84% of what you want, so you're losing there too. Whereas we're using only 1.5 times as much memory and getting 100% of the... In fact, we even get the corners right. And for some application, the corners are important. And there was nothing gained by throwing out the corners in this method. I mean, you can't... it wouldn't be worth doing anything special. You might not want to evolve those in the simulation. But in our simulation, we evolve the corners too, although sometimes we zero them out, we remove them. But we have to specially go and do that. We actually do evolve the corners in our numerical simulation, the corners of the box, outside of a sphere. We do that because it means we don't have to copy this data somewhere else and evolve that. We can evolve the data right in situ. And any kind of copying you can avoid is good, of course, especially when you parallelize. So one of the advantages of this method is that it works right in place. You don't have to copy to another buffer that's bigger enough to have all the zeros in it. Okay, that saves you a lot of time. That's all I have to say, for now anyway. CK, do you want to talk about the sheared box? I think.
Okay. this.
Yeah, sure.
So for the cubic nonlinearity, you have to de-alias with a 4 over 9, so you throw out 6 over 9.
It's actually instead of 2/3, it's 2/4 is the rule.
Instead of 2/3, basically half. So you throw out.
Yeah, you could have, most people call it half, but to connect to the 2/3 rule, it seemed natural to call it 2/4. Yeah.
And if one were doing FFTs, one can do a quadratic, like take two of these three factors. Take them to physical space, multiply them. Bring them back, de-alias, then do a new FFT for the remaining two. Basically, you have a...
It's a double convolution, isn't it? And you can do one at a time. Yeah, that might work.
So you'll get twice as much, you do twice as much FFTs,
yeah,
I think. Mm-hmm. But you can still do, get away with a 2/3 de-aliasing.
Yeah, if you do it that way.
Because you're doing two at a time.
Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing would be to compare, I guess the first time I did this, I did it with explicit aliasing with 2/4 like this. And what you're saying is certainly better than that. It sounds better.
It needs more computing.
Yeah, now right, so there's a trade-off there. Yeah, it sounds better anyway. With the implicit de-aliasing here, of course, we didn't really double the memory usage. We did it with, in 2D, in 2D we doubled the memory usage instead of quadrupling it, right? Because this by this rule you have to square this, right? And so by this rule you would only be left with 1/4 of your domain would be physical modes. With our scheme, we 1/2 of our domain is physical modes. We still have to zero a bit, so it's not so bad. So it would be interesting to compare with. It seems to me we thought about this. I don't think we ever tried it. First computing the, so we compute first, let's call this one, so I guess what you do here, you call.
Well, you can just call it omega, star omega, brackets, then star button.
Let's call this
U,
it depends on K, and P and Q. So you want to keep Q fixed. So K minus Q is the other variable, and P. Yeah, that's what you're thinking of, right? And so this is K minus P, maybe Q. So keep Q fixed, and then compute. So at fixed Q, you would first compute this, right? But the limits on Q, yeah, I guess you can do it. Yeah, I see what you're getting at, and it would be a good thing to do a comparison of. Certainly the 2/4 rule, especially in 3D, that was going to be really bad, and that's what kind of motivated me to do something better, and not read all these zeros. So your idea of doing two different convolutions with 2/3 de-aliasing is a good one, and it's worth comparing. I didn't talk about that. I decided not to. I took that out of this particular presentation because I didn't think anybody would be interested. But so you're interested in for another application, or?
Well, compressible.
Again, the compressible one. Yeah, I didn't realize it would. It came up there.
People doing pattern formation used to have cubic nonlinearities.
Right. Yeah. So that's where it's coming from. Sure. So anyone with a cubic nonlinearity, and I would have mentioned these applications in the paper. But the only one I knew was computing these Casimir invariants. One of the problems with the Casimir invariants, they don't survive truncation. And so we have to use a really well-resolved simulation. You can show that if it's well-resolved enough, that the numerical error can be made quite small, small enough to discern which way the cascade is going. So that's another reason I was motivated to do this, because I had to use extremely high-resolution simulations just to see a cascade. And so that motivated me.
So you mean
save memory?
It's because of the spectrum decays fast enough that.
That's right.
That even though they shouldn't be conserved in a spectral code, they are.
Yeah. I don't know if you know Jahan Shah Davoodi, but he was a postdoc with Bruno Eckert when I was on sabbatical there, and he came up to me with this question a few years ago, Couldn't we examine this issue numerically? And so I'll try to show next week the results of that examination. My first answer to him was, no, you can't do it. It's impossible numerically because they don't survive truncation, unlike energy and entropy. But then I got into actually estimating what the error is. And although I don't have any formal estimates, you could see that the error is all coming from small scales. And so if the spectrum is damped enough there, so you have to go deep into the dissipation range, and then you can actually get a result.
Is it written up somewhere, published, or?
That's one of my things I was supposed to do while here, and I have about 10 days left before I leave. Maybe I'll get it started anyway. Yeah, I have on my webpage. You will find some talks, but it hasn't been published yet. Yeah, so if you look at my webpage under talk, you'll find it. It's called Casimir Cascades in Two-Dimensional Turbulence. So if others are interested, I certainly can give a talk on that next week.
This is also important just to mention that in Boussinesq turbulence, we're not talking 2D Casimirs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something of physical importance, we're talking about potential entropy, which is omega dotted with a gradient of theta being temperature.
Yes,
or
potential temperature,
And the square of that is potential entropy.
Yeah.
That is conserved. Mm-hmm. But it's the same problem, it's a quadratic quantity, it's not. In general, it's quadratic. So basically, it plays the same role as entropy in 2D.
Yeah.
But it's quadratic rather than being, quartic.
It's a quartic. Okay. All right. Now I understand. All right. Yeah.
As opposed to entropy, which is just quadratic.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's the same thing as I was computing the fourth power of vorticity. It would be the very same issue. I can show you what I did a little bit if you want.
Should we move on to other top speakers?
Yeah, I would like to too.
I don't know.
Yeah. We can talk about it after, before tomorrow. Okay, because you leave tomorrow. Okay, so CK, you want to say something now? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I can. So there's another turbulence talk actually in the Galaxy Cluster Conference, so I think we should all go there. So, that means I only have 10 minutes, please, okay.
Well, we could reconvene.
So I actually prepared two things. So one is, as John said, is the spectrum method for the cherry box. So last week, we hear a lot about the planet formation and the cherry box is important. I don't have enough time for that, so I will probably just do something else that's related to what John already said.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you can just wait for my paper to come up. So let me talk about something else. So that means I don't have my talk with me, but it's okay. So it's about spectral sharp capturing. No, I probably don't need that. Let me just build my display. So I guess it's a general statement that people know spectral method is pretty bad for shock. And the general statement is because you have Gibbs phenomena, and Gibbs phenomena is bad. But it turns out that's not the case because spectral method do not have dispersion and you have dissipation error. So although you see a lot of oscillations, those oscillations actually contain the correct information. So it's totally fine to have Gibbs phenomena in your simulation. But the problem there is about the real problem about sharp capturing in spectral method is the energy problem. So let's just consider the because I don't have the talk, so I need to use my Mr. Bradford. So let's just consider the simplest problem we can have, so the Burgess equation. So let's just look at the Burgess equation. Right? So this is the simplest thing. We can try to model a nonlinear system. So the idea now is what happens if you set the viscous term to zero at the really beginning. Okay? So now if you count, you just stop this with the velocity and then integrate. That's just easy 1D. Then you find out the energy is just related to the shock condition. So you have jump here and the jump will disappear energy. Now, but if you do in a special method just for a transform, so everything is continuous, everything is wave. So you don't have the jump condition. So that means if you are using a special method to solve the Burgers equation, and if you do it right with the aliasing, then your energy is supposed to conserve. Okay? Now if you do that, then what is, write up the code and try to run that, then what is going to happen? Do people have any guess?
Be conserved.
Yes, the energy will conserve, but what happened to the solution?
You lost very small scales.
So let me just draw it first. So say we start velocity profile like that. It's Burgers equation, so you will create a jump like that. Okay. Now the convention wisdom is because of the Gibbs phenomena, you get a lot of oscillation here, and then your solution is back. But at the really beginning, I already tell you that these contain the correct information, so they are fine. So how can you conserve the energy in this system? Now let me show you.
Excuse me, so the ripple is not physical, you mean, or?
They appear because you truncate your Fourier series.
Okay.
But they actually contain correct information, and there are methods that you can correct those oscillations and get a really good solution. I can show you a plot later.
If you keep more modes, if you truncate a higher wave number, then the amplitude of these oscillations disappears, doesn't it?
No, the amplitude won't disappear. They will remain there. It's Fourier truncation. The oscillation will go closer to the shock.
Okay. All right. Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so let me just show you this spectral simulation. I hope you.
No.
Try to bring up this time first. Okay. So this is what happens. You see these features over there?
Is it forced or wait? Because new shocks are being born?
So let me repeat this slowly. So that's your initial condition.
Yeah.
Evolved to a shock.
Yeah.
Convention wisdom, this phenomenon appear here and your solution go crazy. But it turns out that this shock is totally fine. And you have something crazy over here. So it turns out this is something I will say pretty well known. If people actually use special method, they see this. But usually they don't take this seriously. And actually I'm not the person who takes this seriously first. It's Yuri who gave this presentation in a conference in Auditor a while ago. So they call this strange feature tigers. So at the beginning, I thought he's just crazy. I don't believe him. But then when I do that myself, I actually see this feature again. So these are the tigers you talk about. So it just appear at the reading this smooth, and they are just totally in sync. Now, if you think about the energy, they actually make some sense because I told you that this oscillation they're going to decay in order to capture the correct solution. But then your energy is still conserved, right? So you have to pop up some energy somewhere. So it just turns out that the energy pop out here. Now why it appear there, you can use field theory and some really detailed mathematics. But for that, you need to look at the paper. Now I'm just going to give you this simple picture that the energy just pop up there. Okay, so this is what happens if you do the spectral method right. You conserve energy, but then you do not converge to the correct solution. Okay? So the trick to use spectral method to capture shock is just to ensure that you can dissipate energy. That's the only thing you need. So now let me show you another simulation. Now that's the hydrodynamic simulation. And this is the unresolved one. So that's the, oh, well, that's not the one I want to show you. That's the one crash. So let me try to, maybe this one. So this is the density, the standard shock to problem. This is under resolved. That means I just put a tiny bit of viscosity to damp out the feature, and you see the tiger again. Okay? So this is the exact same idea, because even in the Euler system, if you solve it with spectral method and you do it right with the padding, then you are conserving some kind of energy, so the energy pop up and you're not getting the convergent solution. Now if you put in some better or higher viscosity, so there is a technique called supervanishing viscosity. And if you do that, you dissipate enough energy, then your solution model, you see the Gibbs phenomenon over there, are actually converged to the right one. So so this is all I want to say in my 10-minute talk, just to tell you that spectral method is able to do shock, providing you give a way to dissipate energy. So that's the key point here.
So wouldn't that be the same as the pseudo method, spectral method? Because they're both calculating the same thing. They're calculating convolution.
Yes.
Roughly the alias, there shouldn't be any difference, right to machine precision.
So in this movie, I actually show you the fully de-aliased spectral code. So we do the de-aliasing. But we can, of course, do it with the pseudo-spectral method. So by pseudo-spectral method, I just mean we do not do the aliasing. It's just,
okay,
just much easier. So if we do that, sometimes it's actually better. Okay. Or this one. Sometimes it's better because you allow more. This one actually crashed. But for the right one, because you allow more modes to interact with your solution in the your mode in the large scale, you can actually dissipate better. So what if you just read the paper by those super vanishing viscosity people, they actually tell you don't worry about the aliasing. You can just use the normal pseudo spectral method and you put in a super vanishing viscosity and then things will work out. Yeah.
So is it
the hyperviscosity? So hyperviscosity usually means del to the sixth, right?
Yeah.
That's what you mean. So what by super vanishing viscosity, people, so this is K6, then people are talking about an exponential cutoff. So instead of doing things in this way, they kill things in this way.
And does it conserve energy?
Oh, you dissipate energy by putting in the filter, but you have to kill the energy in order to converge to the correct solution. Yeah. So So that's it. Then we should find out a time for the frustration box.
Okay. Sure. Great. Thanks. I guess I have one question about the integration method you use. When you say conserve energy, is that to some power of the time step or to machine precision?
So yes, when I say conserve energy, I actually assume you have a good enough time integrator. So at some point I was using a LibFrog because it's sympathetic, but it turns out that LibFrog gives me some phase error in the small scale, so now I'm just using for the launch code.
So it also will introduce error.
Yeah, but it's just a tiny bit.
So there is another class of integrators which basically evolve, instead of evolving the velocity, they evolve the energy, and so you basically transform to a new space, to the squared space.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And then you transform back, and the Runge-Kutta integrator conserves any invariant that's linear in the variable you're evolving, but energy isn't linear in velocity. So transform velocity squared, do your integrator there, and then come back. They're called conservative integrators.
Okay.
There's a reference on my webpage.
Okay, I should look that up.
Yeah.
Thanks for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so any other comment, question?
Well, you didn't get a chance to talk. Maybe can we reschedule this to... Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. But other things I want to talk to you later.
But I'd like to hear about that shifted, the skewed box sometime.
Yeah, okay. You can find a lot of time for that.
Later in the week, we can maybe get another time. courthouse?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. What is the talk on the other one? Otherwise, we can. You want to go yourself to that, yeah?
Yeah, I want to go there. And I think we should all go there.
So, just give us the PDF file. Just click on it.